The following is a lecture given by His Holiness Jayapataka Swami on October 15, 1982 at Murari Sevak Farm in Mulberry, Tennessee. The class begins with a reading from the Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 2, Chapter 3, Verse 19.
Sangstuta purusha pasu na yat karna patho peto jatu nama gadagraja. Translation by His Divine Grace Srila A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada of Text 19, Chapter 3, Canto 2, Srimad Bhagavatam. Men who are like dogs, hogs, camels, and asses, praise those men who never listen to the transcendental pastimes of Lord Krishna. Lord Sri Krishna, the deliverer from evils, purport by Prabhupada. The general mass of people, unless they are trained systematically for a higher standard of life and spiritual values, are no better than animals. And in this verse, they have practically been put on the level of dogs, hogs, camels, and asses. Modern university education practically prepares one to acquire a doggish mentality with which to accept the service of a greater master. After finishing a so-called education, the so-called educated persons move like dogs from door to door with applications for some service, and mostly they are driven away informed of no vacancy. As dogs are negligible animals and serve the master faithfully for bits of bread, a man serves a master faithfully without sufficient rewards. Persons who have no discrimination in the matter of foodstuff and who eat all sorts of rubbish are compared to hogs. Hogs are very much attached to eating stools. So stool is a kind of foodstuff for a particular type of animal. And even stones are edibles for a particular type of animal or bird. But the human being is not meant for eating everything and anything. He is meant to eat grains, vegetables, fruits, milk, sugar, etc. Animal food is not meant for the human being. For chewing solid food, the human being has a particular type of teeth meant for cutting fruits and vegetables. The human being is endowed with two canine teeth as a concession for persons who will eat animal food at any cost. It is known to everyone that one man's food is another man's poison. Human beings are expected to accept the remnants of food offered to Lord Sri Krishna, and the Lord accepts foodstuff from the categories of leaves, flowers, fruits, etc. Bhagavatam 9:26. As prescribed by Vedic scriptures, no animal food is offered to the Lord. Therefore, a human being is meant to eat a particular type of food. He should not imitate the animals to derive so-called vitamin values. Therefore, a person who has no discrimination in regard to eating is compared to a hog. The camel, Stanley wrote, so here we've already discussed dogs and hog like human beings. Actually, in the Vedic culture, Brahmanas, Kshatriyas, and Vaishyas, you see, even a Brahmana, he may accept the occupation of a king or of a businessman, but they'll never accept the job as a salaried person. which is that of a sudra. You see, Chanaka Pandit was the great Brahmin, and he was offered the position as prime minister by the king. And he agreed to accept that position with the condition that he wouldn't accept any salary. He wouldn't live in the king's palace. Or he wanted a separate outside of the king's palace. He wouldn't accept any salary because he didn't want to become... When you accept salary, then you have to do what your boss says. Just like a dog. Look at all the people in customs and immigration. Just because of getting salary, they have to mistreat people, put them through such a hard time. You want to go and see any president of any corporation, you have to go through watchmen, secretaries, so many people who are just there to tell you no. Rough, no. You can't see him. So, this dog-like mentality, however, is being promoted in the Western culture. Not only Western, but whole Western, whether capitalist or communist. Everyone is supposed to simply work faithfully for insufficient rewards. At least in the Western countries, the idea that, well, you can give up your job and try to get another job where you get more pay offers some allurement that, well, maybe there's hope to get sufficient reward. You see, while in a communist country, you just get a completely insufficient amount, but you have to work just anyway. And there's no one who's... This whole Vedic system is very much stifled. Only the Communist Party members have got any real freedom. Otherwise, everybody has to just serve faithfully the established situation. So here, even in America, still there are traders and businessmen. There's a lot of Vaishya. But all the intellectuals and military, they're all become simply the paid people of the government, which is all supported by taxes, controlled by various lobbies. So in this way, big intellectuals, they're going to school, but then they're actually just spending their whole time developing greater types of, you know, products for consumer distribution, everything. So it's actually, there's no question of free thought or actual human characteristics being developed. They're actually just like faithful dogs. They're just serving their master faithfully for money. But they're glorified and given some name and fame and like this recognition. But actually, that type of real independent ability to do welfare work for the people, to do real search of the truth, is hardly given to most of the people. Just maybe a very few actually get that type of independence. I mean, Prabhupada is sufficiently discussed about the hogs. You don't have to really go into it much more. Regarding the camel, it says the camel is a kind of animal that takes pleasure in eating thorns. A person who wants to enjoy family life or the worldly life of so-called enjoyment is compared to the camel. Materialistic life is full of thorns, and so one should live only by the prescribed method of Vedic regulations just to make the best use of a bad bargain. Life in the material world is maintained by sucking one's own blood. The central point of attraction for the material enjoyment is sex life. To enjoy sex life is to suck one's own blood, and there is not much more to be explained in this connection. The camel also sucks its own blood while chewing thorny twigs. The thorn the camel eats cut the tongue of the camel, and so blood begins to flow within the camel's mouth. The thorns mixed with flesh blood create a taste for the foolish camel, and so he enjoys the thorn-eating business with false pleasure. This, you can see this in India. Actually, that they eat, they go to the thorn tree and they eat. They're so stupid that they think that thorns are sweet tasting. You see, because when they chew the thorn, they taste some sweet taste. They don't realize that the sweet taste is their blood. Right? If someone gives you an apple and you eat it, then you have very sweet taste. So it's like that. They don't see what's, you know, happening in their mouth. And they're so stupid they don't realize that their tongue is being cut up. Must not be very sensitive. So when they chew on the thorns, and then they taste the blood mixed with the thorn, they think, oh, this is a very sweet preparation. Wonder why no one else is eating it. They left it all for me. So Prabhupada is saying, similarly, the great business magnates, industrialists who work very hard to earn money by different ways and questionable means, eat the thorny results of their actions mixed with their own blood. Therefore, the Bhagavatam has situated these diseased fellows along with the camels. The ass is an animal who is celebrated as the greatest fool. Even amongst the animals, the ass works very hard and carries burdens of the maximum weight without making profit for itself. The ass is generally engaged by the washerman, whose social position is not very respectable. And the special qualification of the ass is that it is very much accustomed to being kicked by the opposite sex. When the ass begs for sexual intercourse, he is kicked by the fair sex. Yet he still follows the female for such sexual pleasure. A henpecked man is compared, therefore, to the ass. The general mass of people work very hard, especially in the age of Kali. In this age, the human being is actually engaged in the work of an ass, carrying heavy burdens and driving tela and rickshaws. You know tela? In India, this is... You know a bullock has a cart. So in Calcutta, I've been seeing they have bullock cart without the bulls, and instead the men are pulling. It's a small. And sometimes they load on it half a ton, 1 ton of steel or something. And you see them pulling. There's two people in the front and one person in the back. Just like a bullock, they're pulling. And you see them coming down the road. And then all of a sudden, like some big bus or something comes this way. And so then they try to stop. But you got a 1 ton, you know, they don't weigh that much. So then they have 1 ton momentum going there. And they're trying to stop, and you see them straining, and the sweat is, and they're trying to stop, just, you know, not to run into this bus. It's, I mean, you can just, human beings are working just like asses. You see, all because they get, you know, pretty good pay. Because instead of carrying in some little miniature truck, or say you want to just move something in the city that is not a big enough load for a whole truck. A truck may cost 50 rupees, say. So they'll pull it for 12 rupees or 20 rupees. So that way they can do two loads in a day. They'll make 7-8 rupees, about $1 a day. It's a lot of money, you know. And they're pulling rickshaw. The average life of a rickshaw puller in India is something like 35 years old. But just for the money, they're doing it. They make more money than if they were in the village. The so-called advancement of human civilization has engaged a human being in the work of an ass. The laborers in great factories and workshops are also engaged in such burdensome work. And after working hard during the day, the poor laborer has to be again kicked by the fair sex, not only for sex enjoyment, but also for so many household affairs. So Srimad Bhagavatam's categorization of the common man without any spiritual enlightenment into the society of dogs, hogs, camels, and asses is not at all an exaggeration. The leaders of such ignorant masses of people may feel very proud of being adored by such a number of dogs and hogs, but that is not very flattering. I was in my previous life some movie. I forget what the movie was, but I remember the one man was driving and he looked, and it was a traffic jam, and everyone he saw in the traffic jam all turned into sheep and goats, and they were sitting in their car you know, in the, I don't know, it was some comedy or something, but it was supposed to show, like, everybody was just like an animal or something. Showed, you know, all dogs, sheep, all the people turned into animals waiting in this traffic jam. I guess it's like the rat race.
Yeah.
You can see here the imagery. There the leaders are speaking. I saw yesterday in the paper, it showed there was some elephant and one ass were embracing each other, shaking hands. These are the symbols of the political.
Yeah.
You see, so they're already, you see, preparing for their next bodies. So the leaders, when they're speaking, then you can just see that all the people, you know, transformed into asses, dogs, hogs, camels, applauding them. Roof, roof.
When we used to do the football games, you know, we used to distribute the football games. Georgia, they call themselves the Bulldogs, and everyone, all Georgia fans, go around and they rough like dogs, you know, make noises like dogs, and they'll say, you know, we used to run up and pin something on them and say, are you a dirty dog? Yeah, I'm a real dirty dog, you know, and then there was the Razorbacks, the Hogs, the Arkansas, and then you'd say, are you a hog? Yeah, you know, completely identified with. Or they're a gator, or they're a, you know, a tiger, or they're crazy.
If they die in that consciousness, what birth will they get in the next life, Steve, if they die, thinking that they're a dog?
Dog in tell me, huh?
So the Bhagavatam openly declares that although a person may be a great leader of such dogs and hogs disguised as men, if he has no taste for being enlightened in the science of Krishna, such a leader is also an animal, and nothing more. He may be designated as a powerful, strong animal or a big animal, but in the estimation of Srimad Bhagavatam, he is never given a place in the category of man, on account of his atheistic temperament. Or in other words, such godless leaders of dogs and hog-like men are bigger animals with the qualities of animals in greater proportion. Just like right now, there's a court case going on in Florida, Palm Beach. Pulitzer divorce case. And Pulitzer, I don't know, he's something to do with the Pulitzer Prize. I think it's the same family. I don't know if it's he or the same family. He's a big, famous person. And so what the whole case is, who's going to get the custody? There's a divorce case. Who's going to get the custody of the children? So in the case, each one is accusing the other of how this one is taking cocaine and the other one's a lesbian and this one's a homosexual, and how this one, the wife apparently went to bed with 12 different people, from the butcher to the baker to the chauffeur to the, you know, then it, you know, they had all these, then they had some video things of how she was so degraded, and then she's coming around and saying how he's so degraded. Huh?
Should take them away from both of them.
Yeah. So the but this is like the high society. So here is saying that in this, without having any God consciousness, these so-called big, strong, influential people, what it comes out is actually they're just stronger, powerfuler, more animalistic than even the ordinary people who are looking up to them. They're in all the magazines, they're the big people, society is emulating them, is imitating them, their standard of enjoyment they want to follow, and they're lower than the lowest. They're more sinful than even ordinary people in the material world, who may be working like asses or like camels, but these people they're just, you know, maha pushu. Great animals. So this is the kind of situation that this world, the so-called leaders, if you go into their private life, they actually are morally bankrupt, spiritually bankrupt people in almost 99% of the cases. My experience in college, I came there and wanted to, it just came also out in the paper. Now a big problem is that all the professors in college are regularly having sexual relationships with their students. And this is creating psychological problem because the students are looking up to their teachers, hypothetically. And instead, the teachers are, they're coming for some tutoring or some this, that, and instead they find it's easier to get good grades is just to have relationship with the teacher. And of all varieties and forms. So the thing is that all these so-called cherishable institutions in society, they're just gradually completely decaying. When we were in Florida seeing these different displays, they showed history and they showed how Rome was in a big success. They were doing so many economic developments. And then they showed, and then Rome, because of hedonistic tendencies, because of enjoying too much, it crumbled. But somehow, in the whole exhibits, the idea that people should limit their enjoyment or anything, like, even though they showed that, but in the modern day world, where is the slightest bit of caution to people? I haven't seen any symptom. The slightest bit of caution, even a moral or care, apart from like now that Reagan, the president said he's going to do a $200 million drive to stop drugs. By having, you know, but there's no program for training the people to have a higher taste or to understand a real purpose of life whereby they wouldn't want to take drugs. He said, we're not going after the pushers, we're not going after the users. We want to break the organized crime, we want to break the big rings. But the people, they want these things because they're spiritually bankrupt. Just arresting the promoters of organized crime and that, of course, how much of the money they're spending to catch these people, what's going to actually happen is another thing. Usually these things are just political ploys. But the actual thing is what's being done for the actual people. The fact is that it's $80 billion business known by the government in drugs in North America, in America alone. $80 billion, that's probably just a fraction of what the real total is. A known $80 billion black market, apart from whatever, and that's probably more than most of the nations in the world have as a gross national product. But then, what is being done to actually educate the people not to take drugs? You have Pulitzer and all big people, they're all taking drugs. Everyone is doing these things. Big members of Senate, of Congress, you see in the paper come up that they're taking cocaine or something before they go to get a big leak.
I just heard on the radio, it just happened up here just in the town, not too far. Church of Christ, the pastor got arrested for dealing marijuana. This guy, he was 45 years old or something.
Well, here in Lynchburg, the football coach was fired because he was gambling with the players.
Gambling in what way?
Card games, money.
So, of course, this is the duty of the king, or of a ruler on one hand, an administrator, is he's supposed to see that the black market is stopped. But in the Vedic society, that's why they would be supporting Brahminical preachers who would actually be educating the people and what is the proper moral standard, what is the proper spiritual goal in life, so that people themselves would not be so inclined to do all these things. And now I used to say the so-called Christian priests who are technically possibly supposed to be fulfilling that obligation here, but they're as much a party to it as anyone else. maybe some of them are slightly better than the general mass, but in general, the task is a very huge task, and it requires a perfect example. So that's why the Bhagavatas, or the pure devotees, who actually can lead pure spiritual life and can show the people what is the proper standard for leading human life, they are essential in society. People who say that, well, you're parasites on society, or so on, actually then, if the brahmanas are parasites on society, then what are all these law enforcement people? They're spending $200 million to pay the salary of people who are supposed to go underground and break into these drug smuggling rings. They can spend $200 million for that, but how many people, if Krishna consciousness received the support and people became Krishna conscious more and more, gradually giving up all these type of bad habits, think how many millions and billions of dollars they're going to save. So actually we're doing the greatest service for society. And we're not even charging them $200 million for it. But if they want to give us, we will use it also. In fact, we might as well write to Regan that he should give half of it to us for stopping drug. We'll distribute a lot of prasad, do big festivals, get everyone to chant Hare Krishna. They don't have to use any drugs anymore. Right, Steve?
Exactly.
Haribo!
Some of the things which Prabhupada said about it, drugs were, they asked him, I guess this was in New York, someone would ask him, or rather he was talking about it, you don't have to do drugs if you stay high forever. I don't know whether he said it or one of the
they used to hand out things like that, stay high forever. Of course, almost we tend to try to avoid those things nowadays because we know that it's actually an understatement. But that's the actual thing, that by chanting Hare Krishna, one will always be blissful. So all these artificial crutches and artificial type of chemical systems are not at all necessary. But who is going to, where is the person? The leaders, down to the ordinary people. If everyone is practically like a polished animal, then how can they expect to actually uplift the society? There has to be a core of pure spiritually minded people, and by their influence, then actually the type of spiritual revolution which changes this whole direction of misguided society, godless society, is created. But that's the purpose of this Hare Krishna movement. As mentioned, the Bhagavatam itself is to create a spiritual revolution in society where the people give up all bad habits, at least the intelligent people. Now there's such a big unemployment problem in the world. So people, they feel very sad that they don't have any employment, that they can't be just like a dog working for their master. They're very sad. And everybody is supposed to work just like that. Rather, now they should be trained how to be as brahmanas. And people should understand that if people actually lead simple life, practice spiritual life, that it's better than the people that are just sitting in their home all day playing cards and watching TV and taking welfare checks. But actually, the unemployment problem would be solved if a good percentage of the people were engaged in spiritual life. Nowadays, if you want to become a minister in one of these Christian churches, you get about $30,000 a year salary. In a Roman Catholic big parish, you get about $30,000 and a minimum wages in the 20s. Car, TV, your own house. If you're Catholic, you have to be celibate. But then if you're a Protestant, then you can also be married. So it's a big paying salary. And you only have to work for 8 hours, you only have to work for about 3 hours a week on Sundays. Huh? 52 days a year. Well, then they got a few other holidays, I guess. So, the point is the devotees, they're not taking any big salaries, but actually they're working for uplifting people. This should be recognized as a very important service. Hare Krishna. Questions? Yes?
Can we tell the rest of that story you started in New Orleans about the phrase book distribution fighting and then you continue it at the next prashan?
Where did I end?
Well, the books got stolen. The books got stolen. It's raised up.
You never heard that before.
I remember hearing a story up to there, but I don't remember how it ended.
Everyone wants to hear that?
Yeah. What about how it ended? Like,
tell us the first part. Some of it's the near personal.
I don't know what's going on.
Well, the first part is that the deity Govindaji told Srinivasacharya to take the books of the Gaudiya Vaishnava writers in Vrindavan, the six Goswamis. So then Narottam Das Thakur, Srinivasacharya, and Shyamananda Pandit were given armed guards and books, and they were sent off by all the six Goswamis that were left, the Jiva Goswami, Gopal Bhatta Goswami, Raghunath Das Goswami, Krishna Das Kaviraj, Lokanath and others, or Bhugarbha and others, Dvija Haridas, somebody, whoever was there at the time, they all saw them off. They went to the east. And then what happened was there was this one king called Birambir Bikram Mahadev Shah, something like that. And he was in the king of Vishnupur. And he had an astrologer who used to tell him when any very valuable treasure was coming along the highway through his kingdom. And he had a special band of CIA. Green beret, black beret, whatever, who would dress up like thieves and go out and then rob and bring the things to the king. And when people came, he would say, I will try to catch the thieves. But actually, he was the bigger thief. His astrologer told him that there's a very, very valuable treasure being carried just by a few people. It's not very well guarded. And this is the most priceless jewel, according to that calculation. It's the most valuable thing. So then the king became very excited. And he called his crew and told them, go out. There's a big box, you bring it. Very good astrologer. So they came and surrounded the camp of Srinivasacharya and Narottam and waited. And when they all went to sleep that night, the guards that were up, they also dozed off. So they just came in and right off the carriage, they stole the big box of all the manuscripts, Chaitanya Charitamrita, the only single one manuscript. They're being taken to be copied in Avadvip, the originals. They stole them. And they had a big lock on it. So they took it to the king. The king rewarded all of them with 200 gold coins and sent them off. And then he had it taken in his back room. Then he had his assistant from the treasury break off the lock
and he opened it up. There's no jewels. Instead, he saw they were all manuscripts. He said, "What is this?" And then he looked at the manuscripts and he found, see, the Chaitanya Charitamrita had been put in the bottom, but automatically somehow it had come up on the top. And he was looking and he couldn't. He said, "These are all sacred scriptures. They're quoting from the Vedas and things." And so he became very afraid that now my sinful reactions have caught up to me. He was stealing gold and things from people, but he was giving in charities, brahmanas, and trying to neutralize it. But here he could realize this is only the property of some great saints, some great Vaishnavas, so that they have stolen, that I have stolen, this is the property of some great scholars, some Vedas. Now I'm going to be guilty of a great offense. All my pious activities are finished. Everything is now going to be finished. I'm going to be severely punished for this great offense. And he couldn't also understand what these books were saying. It was very deep. So he had some of his scholars trying to read him. They were giving all cockeyed understandings. So then he locked everything up and he sent a special messenger to find who is the owner of these books. In the meantime, the morning came, Srinivas and then Narottam and everyone, when they woke up, they saw the books were gone. They had been empowered by all these great devotees, by the deity, and then the books were gone. They were completely shattered. I mean, they were fainting and pulling their hair out and beating their head against the trees and crying, and they were completely mad. How would they ever be able to even exist? They just knew that once this news came back to the residents in Vrindavan, this is going to be a crushing blow. The original and only manuscripts, the whole life work of Krishnadas Kavila, everyone, all of them were gone. So then Srinivasacharya, he said that, well, whatever Krishna does, it must have some purpose. I can't imagine that these are going to be totally lost. I'll find them, you both go on to your preaching area, and as soon as I find them, there's no use of all three of us staying here. I won't rest until I find you, go on. So then, they went on, after he insisted, and then he was searching in all the different towns and villages, asking. He couldn't find any clue. Somebody said, "Go see the king. You go see the king, Biram Bikram Mahadev Shah." So then, he went to the court of the Bonapur Raja. When he came in there, he found that they were speaking on Bhagavatam. But they're giving some Mayavadi type of interpretation. It wasn't a proper interpretation. So then he objected that this is not the proper explanation. And in those days, you just don't challenge the king's head pandit like that unless you're very sure about what you're doing. Because otherwise you can find yourself one head lighter.
Light in it.
That's ultimate type of lightheadedness. To be headless. So then, the king, he said, "All right, so then you explain it. You're so sure yourself, so you explain." So then he started to explain, and he gave such a wonderful explanation that everybody was charmed. And the king had an idea, maybe this is the person who belongs to the books, who the books belong to. So he took him in the back, and he said that, "You tell me your purpose. Who are you? What have you come here for?" The king asked him, and then
Srinivasacharya explained how that in every age the Lord is coming down as the Supreme Personality of Godhead. But in the Kali Yuga He comes in the covered form. And that same Supreme Lord has come as Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, who is known as Nimai Pandit in Navadvip. And He was accompanied by great souls, by so many great souls, like Nityananda Prabhu and others. Then He explained the whole mission of Lord Chaitanya and how Lord Chaitanya had delivered the Prime Minister of the Hussein Shah, of which this king was actually a subordinate king. So naturally this king was under Sanatana and Rupa Goswami. Although he was a king, he may got the 21-gun salute, but as the prime ministers of the emperor, they actually had much more power than he did, because they had the whole emperor's army and everything under them. So they explained how Rupa and Sanatana had left, and the king, he had always thought that Rupa and Sanatana were nuts for having left their position. He could never understand why they went off to join Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. But now Srinivasacharya was personally explaining how this was happening, how they and so many other great souls had taken shelter in Vrindavana, and how there Lord Chaitanya had never written any literature, but He had instructed them, and they had written all these transcendental literatures for giving the highest spiritual welfare for all of the people. And that He had been entrusted with all of these literatures to bring them from Vrindavan to Navadvip to have them copied in Bengal by the scholars there. And He was accompanied by the prince of Keturi, who had also become a mendicant. Narottam was actually a prince. He was heir to the throne, but he abdicated. Abdicated, you call it? Or abjugated? Abdicated.
Abdicated.
And instead became just a like a sannyasi, a preacher. So then he explained all this and the wonderful qualities of Narottam and others, and how they came, were carrying the books, and how then they were stolen. And now he has no other purpose in life but to regain these books. And when the king heard all this, then he knew this is the person. Actually, I am the one who has stolen these books. I have sent my robbers. And see, this king would regularly hear the Bhagavatam. But he was hearing the Bhagavatam and he was still having all these material attachments. He would, because he never had a pure devotees reading the Bhagavatam, it wasn't having the same effect. Somehow by hearing the Bhagavatam, even though it was not from pure devotees, and even though he was so attached to material thing, because he was hearing Bhagavatam regularly, somehow he got this special mercy to have association with a great acharya like Srinivasacharya. So he admitted everything, and he was very afraid of the reaction he would get, and he prayed that somehow or another he should be forgiven. So as soon as Srinivas heard this, he said, "Well, can I see the books? Take me there, let me see." And then he was taken there, and then they opened up the box, and there he saw the Chaitanya Charitamrita was unusually on the top. And the king explained how that was just the way he found it. He didn't mess around with it. So then the king actually asked Srinivas, he said he became very attached to, he asked Srinivas to please explain these books to him. He was very interested in understanding them. So then Srinivas started to explain some of the books. So then, in brief, so the king requested that you become my royal guru, you become the guru of the whole kingdom. I will get all these literatures copied, I will see that they're disseminated, I'll do everything for you. You please be my guru, you stay here, and you initiate me. But Srinivas said that I won't initiate you yet, you have to prove yourself. First of all, he got him to copy some of the books, and then he said, I want to send immediately a message to Narottam and to Shyamananda that everything is all right, because they're very much concerned about this, and one messenger to Vrindavana, because by now the word had already reached Vrindavana and they're almost just like ready to die to thinking that the books had been lost. So then, in the meantime, the queen of the king had overheard some of these things, and she fell at the feet of Srinivas and also requested him to give her initiation, and that she was also very attracted to wanting to see Narottam Das Thakur, having heard so many things about him. So he said that he would arrange to bring. So then, while these books were being copied, and Srinivasacharya, he went to see Narahari Sarkar. And Narahari Sarkar told him that he should get married, that he shouldn't stay as a, and he should take that assignment as the king of the guru, whatever, the guru of the king, get married, because he is a Brahma Griha, a sannyasi in those days could never accept a royal position like that. As you know from Chaitanya's dealings with Maharaj Prataparudra and others. So then Srinivasacharya got married, and then he took the position as the king's guru, and he came back and saw the king was chanting, was doing everything. So he gave him first initiation. Much later he also gave second initiation. So in this way, then the books were copied, and from there they were disseminated to all the devotees. And still the ashram of Srinivasacharya in Vishnupur is there. That name, the king was given the name Sri Krishna Chaitanya Das.
So did he leave sannyas to get married?
He wasn't a sannyas.
He wasn't a sannyas.
He went as a young man.
As a mendicant.
Yeah, he was like a brahmachari. He was looking for his guru. He went all over India. And then finally, when he got to Vrindavan, he found Gopal Bhatta Goswami. Jiva Goswami found him and brought him, and in a dream, Rupa and Sanatan told him that he should take initiation. They told Jiva Goswami and Gopal Bhatta, Jiva that he should bring him to Gopal Bhatta, and Gopal Bhatta that he should accept him as a disciple. So then he was initiated by Gopal Bhatta, and he studied the Bhagavatam under Jiva Goswami. But he hadn't taken sannyas. He was very young at that point. I mean, younger man. Say roughly in his 20s, late teens, 20s. He left, just in his teens, he left to go to Jagannath Puri to find Lord Chaitanya. But I don't know, it must have taken him a few years to actually get up to Vrindavan, because he kept going back and forth between Puri and Navadvip. Twice he went, and to get all the way walk to Vrindavan is a pretty good walk. It's about 1,000 miles. Huh? They don't travel in the rainy season. How long it takes to walk from Mayapur to Vrindavan?
I don't know the Okinawans. I don't know what is going on.
From Mayapur to Puri?
I don't know. By train it takes 12 hours.
You are spoiled. Modern sadhana. So in that way, the first book distribution happened. So, what time is class tomorrow morning?
Usually have class starting about 6 o'clock. But, it's flexible.
Well, that's pretty good, because we actually have to leave about 8, right? 11 o'clock, 10:59 is that flight.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, so we have to leave 2 hours ahead.
So that means 8:30. So 8 o'clock.
That would be 9:30 this time.
No.
London tour.
The plane leaves 10:30.
It leaves, all right, 10:58.
It's about 11 o'clock. That's 12 o'clock our time.
Yeah, so it's going to be about 2.5 hours. Plenty of time.
It's not like
9:30.
9:30 my hour time.
Right now it's 9 o'clock Nashville time.
Yeah.
Oh, so we're actually an hour ahead.
Yeah.
In other words, we leave here at 9. It's 10 or 8 o'clock.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Nashville time. So it's best.
That would be too early.
Give us 2.5 hours.
Say so it's like, you know, you can get bored 20 minutes before the flight takes off. You can, there's no law against being there 20 minutes ahead of time. Because I'm always late anyway, so it's best to shoot for the.
So say 9 o'clock.
If we shoot for 9, you'll see that it'll be close to 9:30 anyway.
Indian time.
Huh?
It's Indian time difference. She's not coming.
Just like this morning, we were supposed to leave at 10 o'clock. The flight was at 10:30. We were supposed to leave at 9:30. 9:15. Instead, we left at 9:45. Half hour to the airport. Half hour, 40 minutes. Somehow we got there at 18 minutes.
Lions.
So a little kirtan, we'll give out some of this prasad. Bhaktivinoda Thakur, I heard he used to go before the train took off 5 hours ahead of time and just sit there.
Mm.
So he wouldn't have to go through that whole anxiety, whether you're going to miss the train.
Prabhupada, you'd like to be there, what, an hour? He said that Lady Mary would like to be there an hour before the flight took off. And then one time they were late, he really got agitated.
Yeah, it's an artificial, unnecessary kind of anxiety, I think.